For the point of the recording, can you just state your name and where you live?
I'm Gervais Ronald Paul Jordan, and I live in a house called Beeswing, on Workhouse Green in Upper Road, Little Cornard.
Awesome. And when were you born, Gerv?
When? 24th of August, 1955.
And do you have any memories of the war?
Only things that happened after, or things that I saw. I was born 10 years after the war, but there was a lot of evidence about when I was a little one. We still have in Spout Lane a gun turret that was put there to defend the valley. Where I was born, which was the One Bell Inn in Little Cornard, 800 yards up the road from where I live now, that was a searchlight emplacement, and that had concrete areas where the searchlight stood and also where the machine guns that covered the searchlight stood. And they were there for a long, long time after I was born, so I remember those when I was a youngster. And I had a father who was in the RAF, so I had a lot of stories, heard a lot about it. But yeah, a lot of my memories are passed down from my father. My grandfather never spoke about the war. You couldn't lure him into it. He didn't want to. My dad was conservative with what he said. My mum worked on farms locally as part of the war agricultural, which was not the Women's Land Army. Women's Land Army was something different. They drafted women in from all over the country to work on the farms, but the war agricultural was sort of like a local management group, and my mum worked for them. So she was out in the fields during the war, and with all the air bases that we had around here, we had them at Sudbury, Lavenham, I think where else, Waldingfield, which is strictly Sudbury, over the other side of the river in Essex, a lot of bomber bases, most of them particularly American bomber bases. They started building them, most of them in 1943. And by 45, the war was over, so there were only operational air bases for just over a year. But my mum witnessed many, many times. The Americans used to bomb during the day, and the Royal Air Force used to bomb during the night. So these guys would be out, and they'd be coming home, and she'd see the planes come home, and there'd be people hanging out of them. Engines missing, parts of superstructure missing. More than one occasion, she's had aircraft crash in the same field that she was working in. Guys falling out of planes and disappearing in the ground about a foot or 30 centimetres in a new money. She witnessed as much horror and awe as what my dad did. And my dad was in the RAF with Bomber Command, Coastal Command, Fighter Command. 3.5 years in Gibraltar, working with a branch of Fighter Command, building Spitfires for the invasion on the African front. When he went out there, my mum didn't know where he was going. He said, "I'm being posted." She said, "Well, where?" He said, "I don't know." And that was it. She never saw him for 3.5 years. When he came home, they got married in 1944 at Assington Church, which is the next village up. And I came along in 55, based on the decision that they wanted a few years together without war going on before they encumbered themselves with a child or children. And they encumbered themselves with me.
Did any of either your mother or your father have siblings that fought in the war?
My dad had a brother and two sisters. He actually had two brothers, but one died very early on. Peter, he died at 7 years old. My dad's brother Bernard worked on the railways during the war, so he stayed in this country. He had two sisters. I don't think either of them were directly involved. I know Auntie Daphne, my dad's oldest sister, she worked for the war agricultural, the same as my mum. And my dad's younger sister, Heather, wasn't really old enough to get involved in anything because she was a real youngster of the family. My mum had a sister who was a farmer at that point, and two brothers who worked on farms, so they were reserved occupations, so they never went away. So really my dad was the only one who ever saw active service.
And you said that there was a gun turret where nearby where you grew up. Did you play on it?
Yeah, it's just it's about 50 yards down the road at the top of the hill where we go down the side of the valley to the main road. Excuse me. It's probably 30 foot above the road on the steep side and almost level with the garden behind it on the good side. And we used to go and stand on the top of it and pretend to shoot German aircraft down and be soldiers and airmen and all sorts of things and play on it and in it. My father was horrified because if we'd have fallen off, we wouldn't have survived because it was straight onto a tarmac road. But we regularly used to go there. The interesting thing about that was that it was in the garden of a house or bungalow called Gordon Hills, which we all affectionately call the banana bungalow because it's shaped like a banana. And that was owned by a wonderful guy called Brigadier Reeve, ex-army brigadier. And we used to cut his grass for him and help tidy up his garden. Majority of my close friends in the village were 4 or 5 years older than me, so they were born, you know, nearer the end of the war. But we were always intrigued with war stories, and Brigadier Reeve would tell us nothing gory, but he would tell us about tanks in the desert and convoys of vehicles and all these sort of things and thousands of troops marching. And when you're young like that, you're very impressionable and you love a bit of excitement and action. And we would say, Brigadier Reeve, yes, boys, can you tell us about when you were in the desert? I'll make a cup of tea and get you boys some lemonade. And he'd sit and talk to us for an hour. And it was amazing. Beautiful guy. Had lost his wife, so he lived on his own. But he would tell us, you know, without getting too deeply into the blood and gore of it all, about what he'd experienced and where he'd been, what countries he'd been in. I mean, it was all magical to us. There was no Google then. You couldn't go, oh, where was he? I'll Google that one. Oh, it looks like that, does it? If you hadn't got a decent atlas, or you found it in a newspaper, there was no access to any knowledge, only that you picked up. When we were small, we used to buy Airfix model kits, plastic kits of aeroplanes and tanks, guns, jeeps, anything, and build them and paint them, because probably the war was so close behind us at that point that we still, you know, you thought about it and people talked about it. When you drove about, even after I was born, which is 10 years after the war, there were still places that showed war damage. Factories and houses that had been bombed and not put back up because the company that owned them had probably gone out of business or somebody got killed. So it was constantly there, you know. And we used to play war. And we used to play RAF, or we'd be soldiers. And it was a thing that you got involved in. I don't think anybody does it now. I mean, it's a different type of war now. But when we were young, because of what our parents had told us and what we'd read about, comics when we were young, we had war magazines, and they were about battles, about heroes who were soldiers that had, you know, led their troops to victory or saved all their guys from getting blown up. And you had them when you went to school, you know, when you were probably 7 or 8, you started to look at these war magazines, and they were cartoons drawn by hand. There was no AI or anything to produce these things. Somebody sat there at a drawing board and sketched them out. One of my first ever girlfriend, her dad was an illustrator, graphic artist, and he had done a lot of the war series ones, but he also had done Jack and Jill Annual and various things like that on a nicer side. But, you know, we had collections of these magazines about the war, because it was something that was still And people spoke about it. You know, you'd go out with your uncles and aunts and you'd sit down and they'd sit there and they'd start talking about something that had happened, you know, experiences. But in the main, people were fairly guarded about. They didn't try to relate and draw back up the horrors because there were a lot of horrors. My dad only ever got shot at twice, I think, on an airfield in Lincolnshire one night. He was going around the perimeter track on the airfield. It's a road that leads all the way around the outside. And he shouldn't have been there. He should have been somewhere else. And they shoot first and then ask questions. Bang, bang. Who are you? Edmund Jordan. What are you doing around here? I was just having a ride on my bike. A bit of exercise. You get back down the billets. The second time he was in Gibraltar and they had massive open-fronted hangars. Excuse me, a bit like if you look at some of the air bases that are still preserved around here and some of the things, there's a hangar called a T4 and they're a bit like the standard build T4 hangar but with a totally open front and back, and they used to service Spitfires and other aircraft in them. It's big, you get two Spitfires in crossways on, and a German Messerschmitt flew in over Gibraltar. It had been across to Africa, giving them a little warm-up with its machine guns and whatever, and it came onto the airfield and they'd just walked out of this building to go and have a cup of tea about 5 o'clock in the evening, and this plane came in. They looked and thought, who's that? We're not expecting anybody. My God, it's a bloody Jerry. And they ran, and he flew in one end of the hangar with his machine guns going and out the other end. But you see, those machine guns only worked, I think you had about 6 minutes of ammunition because they fired so rapidly. So he'd probably been somewhere and not had a few shots and thought, right, I'll show him. I'll come back in over Gibraltar and give the British Airmen a little warm-up. Emptied his guns. And I think that was the only two times he came close to anything nasty. Few attempts at being torpedoed when he went to Gibraltar. He went on troop ship and they went right out nearly to America to come back in, to come into the Mediterranean, because if you went close into the coast, the chances are you get a U-boat and it would sink you. So they went right off and back again, and the same coming home. But they had to employ delay and, or diversion tactics a lot of times, because the U-boats used to find them and try and torpedo them. He said that was all a little bit hairy because they'd be dropping depth charges to try and shock the water and essentially split the U-boats open from compression, just wrecks of metal plates and the water comes in, the U-boat sinks. But when they do that, they start weaving so that the U-boat can't get a fix on them, and then they fire these depth charges over the side, and the U-boat goes, I think we better go away, and off they go in a different direction. But yeah, apart from that, for him it was fairly calm. Airfields used to get bombed, the Germans used to come in and lay into a few of our airfields, but nothing like those who went overseas and got attacked. But.
And your father was an engineer?
He was a ground engineer. He volunteered to join up before he was conscripted. He'd worked in a garage. He came from Barking on the edge of London when it was a village, a bit like, well, it was a bit like Little Cornard where we live now. His family had small holdings and little plots of land and things and were growers and animal keepers. His dad was a butcher in Smithfield Meat Market. But my dad's one big delight was to get into the local garage and work on cars. And they kept saying, you know, for quite a big build-up, you know, there's going to be a war. And he spoke to his dad about it. And he said, if there's going to be a war, he said, I want to be in the RAF, Dad. He said, we want to go and sign up, boy, before they conscript you into the army or something or the navy. And as soon as they asked, he was straight in and he volunteered. And he ended up as a ground engineer, and he was a specialist on Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, as fitted to Lancaster bombers, Spitfires, later on the American Mustang, because it was slow and couldn't keep up with the German aircraft. The Americans fitted Rolls-Royce Merlin engines to them, and they were deadly. Even better than the Spitfire in terms of speed. So he went in as a ground engineer. So most of the time, he worked on all sorts of things, but his essential specialism was engines and particularly Merlin's. He died of cancer in 2001, and I spent a lot of time sitting by his bedside, talking to him, going through everything. So I'd got memories, and, you know, and it was keeping him entertained. Excuse me. And we were talking about the RAF and Rolls-Royce Merlins, and he could quote all the clearances and tightening torques and tolerances on those engines at 81 years of age, the same as when they'd been drummed into him when he was in the RAF, you know, in the late 30s, early 40s. I'd done a good job on him, he was a good engineer. And I followed on. And my son, he took a lot of pride in what his grandfather had done during the war as an aero engineer. My son is senior structures engineer for Airbus Space and Defence, so he's a rocket scientist. And that's all based on his grandfather's job during the war, because when my dad came out of the Air Force, he ended up as service manager for an agricultural machinery company. And my son was never that interested in agricultural machinery, but the excitement of the aircraft and the stories Grandad used to tell him about the aircraft, not about any fighting or anything, but just about the aircraft he worked on. And we've got a good number of 2,000 books in our library. A lot of them are my dad's aircraft books. A lot of books about World War. We have an edition called The War Papers, and it's all the front pages out of all the big newspapers from the start of war to the finish. You've got The Times, The Guardian, The Mirror, and I think The Mirror was in there then, The Express, and it's the front page every day for the whole of the war. And on top of that, a lot of aircraft books. And my dad would sit with my son Josh and say, "Look, Josh, you see that Grandad used to work on those." And this all went in. So it does travel. I don't have any grandchildren, probably never will have, sadly, but I'm sure it would step another foolish generation if it did.
And you said your mum worked in the war agricultural. Does she have any stories?
She had millions of stories. I tried to encourage her to write them down, and as she started getting dementia, she had finished with very, really bad Alzheimer's and didn't recognise me, my daughters or anybody. But I gave her a book for her birthday one year. I said, "Yeah, Mum, look, when you think of something, write it down." She said, "I'll do that, boy." And she filled about 10 lines. But luckily, she told me all the time. She said, "God, it's a day like this when whatever happened." So she had some wonderful stories, some similar to what I said earlier about aircraft coming home, you know, with one wing down, just what they called hedge hopping, just getting home, you know, 100 foot off the ground or less. And they would crash just over here at Waldingfield on the airdrome, you know, boom. And she said sometimes you'd hear them go down and there'd be one bang and that would be it. Another time you'd hear a big bang. You'd look and the sky would be full of smoke. And that means the plane never make it and probably the guys in it. They had a few scares. My mum's sister, I said earlier, was a farmer. Her husband was a farmer, the Garner family. And during the war, they farmed at Severals Farm, which is between here and Assington. You can just see it over here at the back of the church if you look at it. And they had prisoners of war working for them. They had a German called Willy Grotfeld. And he stayed right to the end of the war. And when he went home, he wrote to my mum and her sister on a regular basis from Germany, and they wrote back, but eventually it died off. And he did write and say, "I'm sorry that I don't write very often, probably don't speak English here very much, and I'm losing it, and I struggle to read it and I struggle to write it." And I think that was one of the last times I heard from him. They also had an Italian prisoner of war called Mario. I don't know what his surname was, but it was Mario. And he worked in the wood a lot of the time, cutting down trees and, you know, clearing woodland and that. But he also worked on the farm, hoeing sugar beet and things. So they had a couple. And they were, from what I understand from my mum, really lovely guys. They were happy, you know, "We're not going to get killed because we're here and it's safe, thank goodness. You know, and we didn't want to be fighting anyhow." You speak to most soldiers, I suppose, at the end of the day, they turn around and say, "Didn't really want to be fighting." Yeah, they were lovely chaps. We've got at home some little things that they made, because, I mean, they had to go back to camp at night. They weren't allowed out, so they'd go back to Leavenheath and one or two other places. I think there was some at Waldingfield. We've got two ashtrays that I can never remember who carved what, but it's either Mario or Willie. And they're oval ashtrays, and they've done them out of scraps of wood. And the base is a piece of broken bubble glass, and they painted green on the back, so it's got a little green base. Three little curved cigarette holders, and an owl carved out of a piece of wood with little red eyes, and the eyes were made out of a little piece they cut off a toothbrush. And we've still got those. There are some other bits, I can't remember what there is without looking. I think there's part of a wooden clock body as well, or something like that, that they made. And, you know, they bring it in and say, "Joan, there's a present for you," and they give it to my mum, because my mum spent a lot of time with her sister, because mum lived at Assington, and she used to walk through the wood to the farm. But yeah, we've still got some, and they're getting old now. I'm 70, so if you add that on, that's a long time ago.
And did your mum ever tell you stories of rationing during the war? What food she ate?
They were lucky in as much as they grew a lot of stuff in the gardens, but a lot of people did. But things like butter was a rarity, and sugar. Meat they were fairly lucky on, because they used to keep a few pigs. But yeah, it was hard, struggled. We've still got somewhere some of my mum's ration books, but everything was in short supply. And I think I'm right in saying, even when I was born, some things were still in short supply. Well, there was nothing like bananas or oranges or anything like that, because they never came here. We had this massive blockade when World War II started. We farmed pretty badly in this country, and we relied on a lot of imported products, particularly from Canada, hard wheat for milling to make bread and biscuit. And the first thing the Germans cottoned onto was, ha-ha, if we stop their food, we'll starve the devils out. And then, because shipping was under such great threat, and it was difficult to get hold of stuff, you never got oranges and bananas and grapes and all these things. It was hard enough trying to get basic raw materials into the country. There was a Plough Up Britain campaign where the Agricultural Ministry, or Ministry of Agriculture, went round and encouraged farmers to plough up pasture land and put in corn and grow potatoes and such things. I've got a book at home with a picture of a crawler tractor, and it's going up a Welsh hillside, you know, that's more than 45 degrees steep, and they're ploughing it. And then there's a picture of it later on. They grew potatoes on this hillside, and they ploughed up a lot of rough ground. And I think that was a turnaround for British farming. I like agricultural history, and I like agricultural machinery, and I commentate a lot of vintage rallies on classic and vintage machinery. And if you look at the development of tractors and machinery for working the land and producing food, from the start of the Second World War, a little bit in the First World War, but from the start of the Second World War, things started getting really fast and development took off. And we then went into this wonderful period after the war where they still wanted to produce more food. I suppose if you starve people long enough, you know, they're really enthusiastic to get a lot more food and enjoy it. And that was a good incentive. But initially during the war, you know, Mum would say, "Come on, you know, they used to grow the most peculiar things like linseed and all these sort of things to try and produce their own foodstuffs." And linseed they used to grow for they take the stems and make it into a cloth or a rope. But yeah, Mum, you know, she'd say to me, "Drop a get fish, boy." I said, "What do you eat, Mum?" "Well, we had a garden pig, you know, and they'd kill the pig and they'd have a few sausages and bit of pork and some bacon and things." My mum and dad kept 3 pigs in a building in Assington High Street when they lived there. And somebody came round one day and said, where's your pigs, Joan? She said, well, in the building down the bottom there. I said, oh, right. I said, it's 3 lovely pigs down the road in Freddie Hogger's buildings. She said, is there? She went, he said, they look like yours. She said, they do look like ours, don't they? She said, I never. When she went back home and walked out the back, they were her pigs. They'd gone, got out and got in somebody else's buildings. But they kept pigs, you know, to feed. And I started my business with a pig that my uncle gave me when I was 13 years old. He had a pig on the farm and he gave it to me. But prior to that, my parents kept pigs where we are now. And they also kept pigs at the pub. And they also had up to 300 laying hens to sell eggs. But that was good because all of a sudden you got eggs and all these things. But yeah, it was thin and scarce and you didn't waste anything. But some of it was horrible. This powdered egg. Mother reckoned it was awful. They wouldn't touch it. There were certain things they wouldn't have anything to do with. But yeah, I can't think of any particular examples, but she'd often say to me, you know, when I was young, she'd say, you wouldn't get that during the war, boy. I say, wouldn't you, Mum? No. Good job to get milk. Really? No cream? No. And, you know, you find it hard to believe. But now we know it was right.
And did any... You mentioned that your friends were older growing up. Did any of them have any memories of the war that they shared?
I don't think... I think the oldest would have been probably 7 years older than me. So that would take them to about 47, 48. So we were lucky, I think, that we weren't actually born during wartime. But for them, it was a lot newer memory because they were that bit older. But I don't think, racking my little brain, I don't think that I had any friends who had actually been born during the war, very close to the end of it, but not actually during the war.
And when you were out playing, was the war a scary memory or was it just more exciting?
I think it was exciting, yeah. Not so much now because there was so much more available to kids of all ages to know what horror and gore is, but we were fairly shielded from it when we were young. But the excitement, we understood. There was nothing very visual that you could latch onto. There was no media that you could look at that would say, you know, look, this is what it's like when a man gets hit by a hand grenade. You had to imagine it and you think, oh, he'd go, oh, fall on the ground. We know the reality is far different. We liked a little bit of the gore, but our bit of gore was, you know, you're dead. Oh, fall on the floor, lay on your back, you're dead, you've been shot with a machine gun. And that was as gory as it got. Common sense tells us it was a hell of a lot more gory than that. My ex-son-in-law was an ex-paratrooper, and he was blown up with the detachment in Afghanistan a few years ago. And he had 2 friends blown up beside him, and he was lucky he never got damaged. But one guy lost his legs and the other one lost his life. And when you talk about that, you then start to appreciate how much gore there must have been. But we didn't inquire about it. I think modern technology, availability of information, media and everything like that helps, I'm not sure if it's a good way or a bad way, helps younger people, you know, and people in general to know what it's like. I mean, you watch the news and it says, this may be disturbing, and there's some poor devil with a leg sticking out of a building that's been blown up in Kyiv by the Russians or something like that. But there was never anything like that. I mean, we never had television until I was 5 or 6 years old. Then it was black and white and it had 2 programmes. And half the time you couldn't see those. So we never got fed live information or, you know, anything that was too tangible. The worst were these little war comics or war magazines, and they weren't very graphic. You know, it would be wee and ah and war and big stars drawn, you know, with a man flying through the air. That was about as gory as it got. But I particularly, because of my sort of engineering foundation, I liked the aircraft and the tanks, you know, machines, war machines, lorries and things, and I preferred that. But we used to play war in the garden. We're lucky we all had big gardens, all my friends had big gardens, and we'd go around there, and we'd, you know, three and three, and we'd be in a ditch, and we'd have a stick, and we'd be going, bap, 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 you know, and they'd go, hand grenade, oh, yeah. but we never done anything very gory, in spite of being that close to all that horror. It was pretty horrible. My dad saw some horrible things, you know, aircraft coming back with guys in, you know, been shot in half and lying inside the plane and things like that. But, I don't know what it does to you. My dad was a pretty strong guy, really, I think, mentally and physically.
And growing up, you weren't alive during Armistice Day, but do you remember your parents telling you about it, like, when the war ended?
Mm. There's always a lot of respect in our family for Armistice Day, VE Day, VJ Day, still is. I still buy a poppy and contribute, and always will. I admire my mum-in-law. She's 93 years old, and of course she went through it all, and she's very supportive of any remembrance of the war that they'd been through or on the edge of. She's not, you know, she's a bit younger, so she was at the end of it. My dad would now be 105 if he'd have lived, whereas my mum-in-law was only 93, so there was an age difference between my wife's family and parents and my parents. But we like to watch it on the television if it's on, or at least listen to it, and the minute's silence, always honour it, stand in the workshop, switch it off. I had a lad working for me who's one of my neighbour's sons, and it was on the radio, and we're in there grinding and welding, so I went, he said, what's that? I said, minute silence. Oh God, yeah, you know, put all his tools down. We stood there like this, and you honour it, because a lot of people gave up an awful lot so that we can be like we are now. Makes you wonder whether we're going to stay like we are. It's a lot of unrest again. I lived through what it felt like during the Cold War back in the 60s. And I never really understood it. And I thought, well, it's not war, because my concept of war is, you know, bang, bang. And yet there's a war going on somewhere between us and Russia or something like that. But my dad was very nervous about that, and my mum, and I think an awful lot of people were, because we then got nuclear armament. A lot of family respect. My son, you know, he knows what it's all about, and he still honours it, VE Day, VJ Day, Armistice Day, and my daughter as well. So we still honour it and remember it. Whether it goes on amongst younger people, I don't know. I think the problem is that a lot of younger people can't even with the accessibility to the media that is about, they can't formulate what it was like. I mean, you can look at it, but when you look at something and say, that's what it was like, it's not the same as experiencing it. So, you know, with respect to them, they're never, and hopefully never going to know, what it was like.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Okay.